is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Well, of course, you know the drill. We begin every show, as we have now for a couple of months, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, as he testified in the fall of 2019 at the impeachment hearings. We've learned a lot about him over the course of the last couple of months, and we know he's a twin. We know that he and his brother were escorted out of the White House. We know he assured his father that things would be okay because this was the right country where you could sort of speak truth to power. And what we have learned, unfortunately, is that with Donald Trump in power, truth is expendable. So now, the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay. So I go to Business Insider. I've been interviewed by Business Insider, but it's been a long time. Anyway, I went there and I saw a series of articles. And I was like, you know, I think I want to talk about this. So joining me is the person that put together this series. Marguerite Ward is a senior reporter at Business Insider. She covers diversity, inclusion, and general career and leadership topics. She also oversees my favorite thing, better capitalism. Let me welcome Marguerite to the program. How are you, Marguerite?
Good. Thanks, Arnie, for having me.
It's a pleasure. I have to tell you, I had never heard of this NYU professor, but I think he is my new hero because I want to follow him. I want to go back to school and sit at his feet. He is just someone who sounds so smart, so straightforward, and he gets it on so many levels. You put together an interview, and it was entitled, "The NYU Professor Who Predicted WeWork's Failed IPO Says College is About to Change Forever and Expensive Schools Could Close for Good." The person we're talking about is Scott Galloway. He said that if U.S. universities don't stop viewing themselves as luxury brands, they may not be able to reopen after the coronavirus. But Marguerite, he talked about everything. He didn't just talk about colleges. He kind of talked about, you know, small business, who was going to survive. He talked about corporate America. He made this wonderful concept where he said, you know how corporate America embraces capitalism on the way up, but they embrace socialism on the way down. Love that line as well.
Right.
So let's start with really where your focus was, which was the way he addressed what's happening with colleges and universities. Because as we all know, how do you bring students back when, one, they have to live in dorms, two, they usually congregate, eat, three, they have to be in classrooms, and what we're being told, even as we head into the fall, is that we will not really understand how to address this COVID-19, but more importantly, we may be still talking about social distancing, masking up, small groups. I mean, every one of these things is a challenge for someone who's going to cut a check from anywhere from $10,000 to $70,000 to go to school. And is this worthwhile at this point in time?
Yeah, absolutely. So Scott Galloway brings up a really important point that college is extremely expensive. The private four-year nonprofit institution costs about $46,000 on average. And so when you're thinking about bringing people back to campus during COVID-19, it's just, like you said, a logistical nightmare. Like from social distancing to masks, how do you begin to think about that? And I think it's especially important to note that, you know, I'm hearing just within the media industry that many offices are not going to be open until mid-September. College starts before that for a lot of people. It starts in August.
Exactly.
So it is a logistical nightmare. And, you know, he said something really fascinating when he spoke to Business Insider. He said, the jig is up.
I'm sorry. I've thought that for a while when I looked at the cost, so it doesn't surprise
me. Yeah. And, you know, so he said people are recognizing that Zoom classes and Skype calls and online Google Docs for classes is not worth $18,000, $30,000, $40,000. So this is really laying bare just the exorbitant cost of college, as well as the financial insecurity of the colleges themselves. Right. So that's something that was really fascinating.
Well, you know, I mean, the other thing is, so I look at the cost, and the cost is mind-boggling. And even if you're not looking at a private college, you're looking at like public universities. And what you don't know about my little state of New Hampshire, Marguerite, we are the seventh richest state in the nation. Okay, so poor we are not, right? And we value education because everyone has higher ed here, so they're really smart here. Where do we rank in support for higher education? 50th. And I believe if you doubled our support for higher education, we'd still be 50th. So what does that mean? That means that even though it's quote unquote a public university, it is incredibly expensive. The jig is up in the sense that you've already been taxing students at the public level in my state. At the private level, the cost has gotten astronomical. I mean, kids are spending more in the first year of education than many of them will ever earn for the first 10 years of working, Marguerite.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's, you know, and then because in part, not only will they be working, but they'll be paying off this incredible debt, you know, and the question is, why should you have debt for a Zoom class? I mean, it's just nuts. So he made some really interesting points. And that is that if nothing else, maybe we all need a gap year in the sense that rather than even assuming that you should go back to school in 2020, maybe what needs to happen is that students who are 18 should actually embrace the concept of a gap year, which is very much a phenomena in Europe. Everybody does gap years in Europe. That's just something we don't do. I mean, you know, my mother raised me, and at age four, she was telling me I was going to law school. There was no gap year. There wasn't a gap month, you know, and that probably was not the right strategy, because as he points out, people who actually take a gap year actually value their education more and do better. So this may be an opportunity for that, but what private institution can afford a gap year?
Right. And you bring up an excellent point that, you know, you have the president of Brown University, who recently wrote in a New York Times op-ed article, which I cite in my article, that most colleges, you have the president of Brown University saying most colleges depend on tuition and room and board from semester to semester. She said that remaining closed in the fall meant losing as much as half of the institution's revenue. So you have these institutions being squeezed like never before. And a big part of that, like you said, is the decline of state funding and federal funding. You know, the average amount of student debt is somewhere around $30,000 per borrower. I used to have about $23,000 myself. And I know what impact that can have on your career. It impacts where you choose to live, your timeline for moving out, or even thinking about owning an apartment. So this, like you said, is really bringing to the forefront innovation when it comes to education. So you have more startups saying, you know, maybe we can get in on this online education thing. Maybe more people will be willing to do this at a lower price from a non, you know, Ivy League school. Yeah. And you have college counselors seeing an uptick in the number of people considering a gap year. I think let's see. We spoke with, or CNBC spoke with one counselor who said that usually you only have one or two students per cohort who are thinking about a gap year. And now it's up 75%. Most of the students are thinking about a gap year. So this could mean financial ruin for a number of financially insecure colleges.
And yet what he says is, and he kind of, I feel like in some ways, this is a little bit like banking. Who survives? The big boys and the little boys. The middle range, not so much, you know? And so what you're finding out is that a lot of these schools that were sort of anyway somewhat on the precipice had turned their campuses into country clubs in order to attract students. So it wasn't even the academics as much as all the other add-ons. Well, nobody wants the country club when they're being told not to socialize, when they're being told to keep remote, when you know you're going to keep events down to 10, which means how much football are people going to be watching or playing in? None. How many basketball games are people going to be going to? None. And so in a lot of ways, how do you put a small mid-sized campus, you know, in mothballs? And you really, really can't. And I don't want to see everything go online. I think there's a real problem with that. I think there is value to those human relationships and that socialization that just can't happen with a Zoom experience. It just can't, or an online experience. That's what scares me, because where do we go to bring people from different walks of life, different states, different even socioeconomic existence into a classroom? That only can happen in certain college campuses. It'll never happen with Zoom.
Right, right. You don't have the same level of interaction, of healthy debate. It's hard when, you know, you're just staring at a screen. Sure, you might see other people, but are you connecting? And I think you bring up a really great point that, you know, we're not going to be seeing the Harvards and the Stanfords of the US or of the world topple. I mean, they just have such huge endowments that that would never happen. But you might see, like you said, this middle range of universities. Scott mentioned a few in particular. He mentioned Pace, Drexel, Fordham, really well-revered institutions that might be facing some struggles. So we'll see where that takes us.
The other piece here, and I don't know if Scott actually talked about it in his interview, I also want to say something else. So I live close to the University of New Hampshire Law School, three blocks away. UNH Law used to be a private law school, but then it became part of the university. One of the interesting things about UNH Law is that it doesn't have a dormitory. Okay, it's a separate campus, very far away from the main campus in Durham, New Hampshire. And for a while, there was this talk about having a dormitory. Well, in a bizarre way, the best thing they ever did was not invest in a dorm. Because I have students that live with me. In fact, right now I have a Pakistani law student who's living with me. They are in a better position to sort of be elastic in opening and shutting and doing Zoom classes when it looks like there's a tick up in COVID cases. They may be able to have in-class situations where they may have them socially distanced. The classrooms may have to be half the size, but they can do it because the biggest fear of a lot of these campuses is, what do I do with the dorm? How do I feed them? How do I do this in a way that still protects them and allows them to social distance? You just can't social distance in a dorm. Sorry, sweetheart. So in a bizarre way, UNH may be able to survive this better than campuses that, you know, made that huge investment in dormitories. And right now, a dormitory under COVID-19 is toxic.
Right. Who would have ever imagined that investing in a dorm on a college campus would become a risky investment? I just think that's mind-boggling. Similar to housing, New York City real estate investors, you know, that's something you can always bank on, people living in New York City. Well, people are leaving New York City at record rates. You know, I'm up in Westchester with my family, and so is, you know, half the newsroom is in New Jersey and you know, Massachusetts. So this is unprecedented.
One more thing before we leave the education piece, because I do want to do a little bit more about some of the stuff that Professor Galloway talked. He was really amazing, Galloway talked about. But that is that the other piece is Donald Trump has decided as he approaches. So we've got this COVID-19, we've got this worldwide pandemic. But of course, what does Donald Trump do? But he labels it the Chinese virus or the Wuhan virus, or let's blame China. Well, I get it. And you know, he likes the president of China sometimes, but then he blames China other times. Well, what the Chinese have been doing in the United States, especially when it comes to higher education, is that they have been sending thousands and thousands of Chinese students to America. What folks don't really understand is a lot of these universities, especially those mid-tier ones, Marguerite, you're talking about, the way they're able to pay the bills isn't just, you know, the tuition and the room and board. It's the full freight tuition, room and board of those students coming from China. And what we're going to see now is that number is going to drastically decline as well. So that's another kind of pandemic for higher ed, is that they have the disease and now they're going to have another problem. And that is because Donald Trump has been so over the top blaming China for everything, that the Chinese are basically going to roll their eyes and say, think again if you think you're going to be going to the United States for an additional educational degree.
U.S. admissions are completely global in nature, and I think not recognizing that could come at a cost.
The other thing Scott Galloway talked a little bit about was obviously retail, and he talked about the changing nature of retail, and he talked about healthcare. And I don't know whether you were able to get into the weeds when he did this interview, but what was so fascinating to me is the one thing I was surprised about was he talked about Amazon and healthcare, or Google and healthcare, that he saw these huge sort of online deliverers of, I didn't think services, I thought more packages. But now he really sees them as being sort of the next monster in healthcare and in healthcare delivery. And what I was confused by, and I'm dying to talk to him about this, I thought the storyline from the pandemic was Medicare for all, universal healthcare, that the government was going to step in, and the concept of big pharma, private insurance, private anything wasn't going to necessarily be the future, because what we're realizing is connecting healthcare to work doesn't work anymore, especially in a pandemic where we're seeing so many people losing their healthcare. I'm just really interested in how Scott was sort of playing this off and coming up with the idea that, you know, companies like Google and Amazon would be in the healthcare business.
Right. So he said, besides education, healthcare is the most, or actually he said healthcare was the most highly disruptible industry, followed by education. And
right.
he said it's
right.
it's no accident that Amazon is announcing they're investing a great deal of money in building a more robust COVID-19 testing kit.
And I thought it was because of the fact that they were, all their workers were like contracting it, and they were all in their
right.
huge warehouses. So I'm thinking this is warehouse specific. And he, Professor Galloway, says, oh, honey bun, this isn't about their workers. It's about all workers.
Right. And I think technology and the technology sector in general is filling in the gaps that law has failed to fill. So, you know, the fact that healthcare is tied to one's job in the U.S., the fact that, you know, we don't have things like paid sick leave or paid leave to, I mean, you just have so many policy gaps that now more and more you're having corporate leaders and businesses saying, you know, maybe we can provide that. Maybe we can provide a low-cost healthcare option. So I think that that's something to watch out in the next few years. And I think it's been drastically accelerated by COVID-19.
Well, Marguerite, the other article that you also did was you did an interview with billionaire Ray Dalio, who says America's jarring inequality is a national emergency that is threatening capitalism. Let me just read that first word, billionaire, Ray.
Yes.
And I've got my middle fingers up in stereo, Marguerite. I mean, like, oh, really? You're talking about the jarring inequality and how did you help? I'm trying to figure that out. But it was interesting. And I'm almost wondering when I hear these billionaires suddenly notice, or I see what happens at the Aspen Institute or whatever happens in the middle of Switzerland, you know, I keep thinking, are they noticing and sort of worrying about inequality, or are they worrying that the pitchforks are going to come after them?
Right. So I wish I knew that answer. I don't know it for sure. But it's fascinating that you have a billionaire talking about inequality. And yes, while many people are rightfully skeptical about, why they're talking about it, I think the fact that they are talking about it is a relatively new change. You have leaders like JP Morgan's Jamie Dimon saying that, we need to care about inequality, we need to care about climate change. A couple of years ago, before the 08 crisis, you wouldn't have heard about that. So I think just the fact that they're being more vocal about it is something to take note, because these people do influence policy, they influence what other businesses do. In the article, Ray Dalio talks about how he grew up with a solid public education, going from, K through 12, that's at risk with decreased funding. And he points out some really startling statistics. He says that students who come from families that earn less than 20,000 score on average 260 points worse on the SAT than families earning more than 200,000. And that's no accident. Income, people spend so much on education, whether it's from tutors to the books you have to college admission essay writers. You have growing inequality in education. And I think that's something that really frightens Ray Dalio, which is why he's talking about it.
So I'm the daughter of two public school teachers. And originally from Brooklyn. Their parents, both parents, sets of parents, didn't have anything more than a fifth grade education. They were the first ones to go to college. They went to the best public schools in the world, which were New York City public schools back then. Mm-hmm. I mean, people would compete to try to teach in New York City because the education was so excellent. My father was a New York City school teacher. And by the time he left the profession, Marguerite, this is such a sad story because this was evident in the 70s. I flew to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota in 1971. That's where I went to college. My father flew with me. My father was a teacher of the year in New York. And my father is on the plane with me. This is 71. Remember the date, everyone. My father says to me, "So what do you want to be when you grow up? What are you dreaming about?" And I looked at my dad, who is this amazing teacher. And I thought, well, I'm not sure, Pop. For a while I thought I was going to be a minister or a lawyer, but I always thought that somehow teaching was in my DNA. And my father looked at me and said, "Whatever you do, don't become a teacher." That was 1971, everyone.
Wow.
And the reason my dad saw that was that he was watching the erosion of investment in public education. And so as your billionaire hedge fund manager, Ray Dalio, is talking about the fact that he could point to education, well, what I want to ask Ray Dalio is, it's not just parents who are putting additional monies into education for their kids because they have the financial capacity to do it, but look at the inequity based on geography. And when property taxes are what funds so much of education, property poor towns, the operative word is poor, are not going to be able to do for their kids in a public education system what property rich towns can do. And that's not about parents cutting an additional check for tutors. That's about the amount of money they can actually invest in that education because they're property rich versus property poor.
That's a great point. That's an absolutely great point. And I think, I hope that we will hear more about this topic in the election. Education is crucially important. And, Ray Dalio said that if you don't have equality of opportunity, then you don't have much at all. So
that's the American dream. The American dream is the idea that was the one place where you're given opportunity. You chose to walk through that door. You chose to work hard. You weren't chosen by geography not to be given calculus and algebra and theater and music. That should not have been taken away from you because of where you lived and the income of your parents. And that's exactly what has happened. And it's just so unconscionable. I ran for governor in 1992, And I talked about the fact that we had pockets of excellence in New Hampshire when it came to education and acres of mediocrity. Pockets of excellence and acres of mediocrity. It's 2020. It's still true today. Marguerite, join me anytime. Keep writing for Business Insider. Marguerite Ward writes for Business Insider. She also is responsible for a section that I really love, Better Capitalism. So thank you so much, and we'll be back in touch.
Thanks, Arnie. Thanks so much.
All right, stick around, everyone. Currentcast is next. And then we have a fascinating interview about how personnel is policy.
Using gravity to predict floods. It's a weighty topic on this CurrentCast. NASA satellites monitor changes in the Earth's gravity field. Yes, gravity changes. J.T. Rager of the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory says shifting water masses play a role.
If you have more water in a region, you have more mass there. And more mass is associated with more gravity, and therefore changes in water can cause changes in gravity.
So think of river basins as buckets. When they're almost full of snow, soil moisture, and groundwater, the NASA satellites will measure a small increase in gravity, alerting us that the system is saturated and more likely to flood with added precipitation. Rager says that by combining gravity measurements with weather forecasts, we could see floods coming about 5 months in advance. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Welcome back to Part 2 of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. So Jeff Hauser wrote a piece. And actually what's so interesting, Jeffrey, about the piece is that I've been quoting this line over and over again because I think it's a line that Elizabeth Warren uses a lot. The title of the piece is Personnel is Policy, the Vital Importance of Appointing People Who Work and Think, very good, in the public interest. Jeff Hauser and Dave Siegel wrote it. Jeff is the, now are you still the executive director of the Revolving Door Project? And if you're not, can I become the executive director? Because it sounds like it's exactly something that I would be looking at and wanting to follow, because you scrutinize the executive branch appointees to ensure that they use their office to serve the broad public interest rather than entrenched corporate power or seek personal advancement. Let me welcome you to the program.
Glad to be here. I still run the Revolving Door Project, although I'm sure you could run it as well or better.
Oh no, I'm absolutely not sure. But it's something I've always noticed. You write in your piece, Personnel is Policy, that for whatever reason, Democrats don't seem to be as on top of this as an issue the way Republicans understand how vital it is. If you look at Donald Trump, as we're going into this interview, personnel as policy, let me introduce you to Attorney General Barr. God, if that doesn't make your point with a huge exclamation point, nothing does. Donald Trump doesn't need policy. He doesn't need Congress. All he needs to do is drain quality people out of the executive branch and then appoint his hacks.
Absolutely. I do think the COVID-19 disaster, you know, the public health inherent nature of the pandemic, as well as the unbelievably incompetent executive branch response, underscores the importance of who is in the executive branch. We actually, my colleagues, wrote a piece at the end of February for the American Prospect about Trump's coronavirus team and how it was setting up the country for failure. So this was not only predictable, but it was predicted that when you have somebody like Alex Azar, the Health and Human Services Secretary, who got his start as a pharmaceutical industry lobbyist, he then in a rags to riches story went from lobbyist to president of his pharmaceutical company. He goes into HHS and he built out a team of corrupt and/or social conservative people across the public health space, and they have run America's public health system into the ground. America used to have the best public health system in the world.
Oh, well, you know, let's make sure that we actually start where your article starts. Because this isn't about, oh, look what Donald Trump has done. I mean, everything Donald Trump has done is corrosive. Everything, I mean, he's like a racketeer, you know? And so we're shocked because we're seeing it because he's so bold and blatant, and they're so obviously in his pocket. And so for the first time, I think we're really looking at this personnel within the executive branch, and we want to take a shower. But the problem is, you go back and you look at Democrats who've made appointments. And one of my least favorite appointments is Mary Jo White. Right. And I was following Mary Jo White. And Mary Jo White was appointed by the beloved Barack Obama. So let's talk about the fact that this is really important. And it's not just something that the GOP does. It's something that the Democrats have done, especially since Bill Clinton got elected as a new Democrat. And a new Democrat basically was a moderate Republican that basically wanted to make love to everything on Wall Street. And so since, you know, Bill Clinton, the more and more you see Democrats and Republicans, sometimes it's hard to understand why they made the appointments they did, because it isn't serving the public interest, it's serving Wall Street's interest.
Right. So the Democratic Party, like any political party, is a coalition. It has different elements, and those elements have paid in the past different amounts of attention to the executive branch. The progressive wing of the party has traditionally followed along with the old Schoolhouse Rock song about how does a bill become a law, and they focus on presidential candidates providing proposals for legislation. And if we were in a parliamentary democracy, that would make sense, because if you were elected as the head of the party, you would be able to essentially assure that your primary legislative agenda would get through. But that's not the case in America. The main thing the president does is they run the executive branch. And so we've had progressives focusing on what are the commitments that each candidate is making with respect to their ideal legislation, commitments that no nominee can actually really be held to completely because Congress has a significant say in the matter. But there's been way too little attention by progressives as to who will you appoint. But corporate Democrats have paid close attention. And so Mary Jo White is a tremendous example. Oh. Mary Jo White was a repeat revolver.
I love that expression, a repeat revolver. I have followed her for so long. I mean, to me, she is like the poster child. I want to make a documentary about Mary Jo White and then show it to every Democrat in the country and say, understand who appointed her, okay? But like, tell everyone about Mary Jo White. She's my fave.
All right, so Mary Jo White is a talented lawyer, unfortunately in some ways talented because of whose interests she served, who has gone back and forth between being a prosecutor and a corporate lawyer. She started as a corporate lawyer, then went into the Southern District of New York, and then she left Then she ran the Southern District of New York under Bill Clinton, where she refused to enforce all sorts of laws on white-collar crime. She actually kind of like overtly does not believe that white-collar crime is as significant as other forms of crime. She took on the legendary Robert Morgenthau, who's the inspiration for Law and Order, an estimable figure who is the Manhattan District Attorney. He took on so many white-collar criminals that Mary Jo White, when in private practice, ran a protege against him for re-election and almost knocked off Robert Morgenthau, explicitly on the notion that in around 2005, Morgenthau was spending too much time prosecuting Wall Street bankers. Don't you think like more prosecutions of Wall Street bankers in 2005 might have saved the country a fair amount?
Exactly.
And so Mary Jo White was brought in 2013 by Obama. He bragged that he was bringing in the sheriff of Wall Street because she had this very tough record based off of prosecuting terrorists. And, you know, obviously I want guilty terrorists to be found guilty in a court of law, but like that doesn't actually prove your toughness or you're willing to take on entrenched power. There are a few less popular potential defendants in the United States of America than going after terrorists. And she took that reputation in office. She would prosecute like terrorists, and then in private practice, she would protect the banks. She went to the Securities and Exchange Commission in 2013, and she failed to act on Dodd-Frank, which gave to the SEC a wide array of regulatory responsibilities to implement financial protection. She failed to go after pernicious practices by the big banks. She basically shielded the big banks for 3 years. And even actually, by the end, the Obama people were actually pretty frustrated with her. They did not appoint her thinking she'd genuinely be a sheriff of Wall Street, but they were kind of mortified by how bad she actually was. So Mary Jo White, and not only that, she's actually married to a leading corporate law attorney who himself has revolved in and out of the SEC. He worked for Chris Cox, the George W. Bush SEC chair, when he was undermining regulation and leading up to the financial crisis. He stayed connected to the SEC even while his wife was running it, which was its own conflict of interest. While he was at a law firm, he was on an advisory group. So that's an example of a situation in which Wall Street went to Chuck Schumer, who is kind of their voice within the Democratic Party. Schumer has for a long time made the recommendation from the Senate to what Senate Democrats want to see on the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Mary Jo White didn't do the job. That was what Chuck Schumer's donors wanted. And progressives were slow to start appreciating this, but like due to Warren, due to a variety of progressive groups, my group founded in 2015, one of our first items of interest was Mary Jo White. There are more progressives paying attention to these under the radar to some extent, but critical agencies.
Let me ask a question though, but Jeff, this is what really ticks me off. Because the story that you're telling me about Mary Jo White, I'm gonna have to say this, this kind of reminds me of the idea that Hunter Biden could go work for, you know, this oligarch in Ukraine as Papa Biden, the vice president, is doing oversight over cleaning up the act of Ukraine. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. And everyone says, oh, well, you know, it wasn't a violation. It wasn't a this. I'm looking at Obama and he's looking at terrorism and Mary Jo White. And he's only looking at like one chapter of Mary Jo White's career. Mary Jo White made her money not on fighting terrorism, but representing financial institutions and corporate America. Mary Jo White was the epitome of the revolving door. You point out who she's married to. You tell the story of Morgenthau. I mean, you look at all this and I'm thinking, who actually vetted her? I mean, what kind of a vet is it where you point to terrorism when the assignment isn't terrorism, it's bankers? You know, it's the SEC. It's people that she's been hand-holding with forever. That's where I want progressives to wake up and smell the coffee. But I also want to start exposing these people like Barack Obama and ask him, what were you thinking? Or what was someone else thinking that encouraged you to wink and nod and look the other way? Because there should be no excuse for Mary Jo White to be the head of the SEC. By definition, she was not going to be aggressive. And after the failure of the 2008 economic meltdown, we needed as a public, someone who really would be a sheriff and would remind them that the banks did not serve the public interest. They basically destroyed the economy.
Absolutely. I think we should think about politicians in the main as neither permanently friends nor foes, but they respond in somewhat predictable manner to stimuli. And yeah. So it's our job as progressives to provide the sort of stimuli that influences their decision making. So right now, a lot of us have been raising a light on the fact that Larry Summers has been advising Joe Biden. And there is also the fact that Joe Biden's being advised right now on economic policy by some very good people, Heather Boucher, Jared Bernstein, and others. But he's been advised by Larry Summers and some Summers proteges, like a woman named Natasha Sarin. So you have both good and bad appointees. And that's kind of like a standard Democrat, is that they're going to be listening to both good and bad people. And so it's the job of progressives to make it more pleasant for Joe Biden to listen more to the progressives and less pleasant for him to listen to the conservatives. And so there's been a backlash. I've been particularly heartened to see groups that focus on green issues, as well as the youth vote, beginning to talk about the Larry Summers Sunrise Movement, a whole host of green and youth groups, Justice Democrats, have been talking about the possibility of Larry Summers advising Biden, taking a very strong line on that. And there's been all sorts of pushback from the Biden campaign. There have been some distancing that's going on. And this is not a battle that has been won in a meaningful sense. It's like an initial skirmish.
Yeah.
But what has to happen is that if you are the junior to mid-level staffers who are considering the names to bring up the top for the Securities and Exchange Commission, for maybe even much more esoteric positions like CFTC or FERC or the government, you know, the CDC used to be pretty obscure until a few months ago, right?
Right.
All
exactly.
of these agencies matter now, or they might matter down the road.
And so let me ask a question, Jeff. So I'm very provocative on my Facebook page, my personal Facebook page. And so I'm always talking about stuff. So I got a reporter called me up the other day and said, so if you could pick anyone to be VP, anyone, and I know that Biden is going to be female, and you know he's sort of implying that it may be a person of color, but I'm thinking, okay, I'll stick with the female. I like the idea of having two breasts in that office. And so one of the things I thought about was, you know who I want? I want Katie Porter.
And she's tremendous.
She's tremendous. And the reason I want Katie Porter is that sends a powerful message to Wall Street. It sends a powerful message to people who have been sort of abusing the public trust, using it basically. We just interviewed someone in the first interview where we talked about sort of corporate America that believes in capitalism on the way up and socialism on the way down. And Wall Street is a perfect example of that. And I thought, you know, Katie Porter sends a powerful message. And someone said, well, Arnie, what about Stacey Abrams? And I want to share this with my audience. I love Stacey. I think on voting rights, she's incredible. But let's talk about her relationships with banks. Because she has really, really interesting relationship with bankers. And if you look at her career when she was in the Senate in Georgia, it is a situation where she actually overturned a progressive Georgia Supreme Court decision that was really serving the consumer and serving the public. And she was responsible for overturning it. Shocked to everyone. And she served the banks and she didn't serve the public good. So I just want people to know that you're right. Not everyone is all good or all bad. And sometimes they do certain things and sometimes they don't. But what I love about Katie Porter is that what we've seen her do, even though she's, you know, new to the game, is that you see not only does she get the policy part, but you get the sense that she is personally committed to this policy.
Absolutely. I mean, so Katie Porter serves on the House Financial Services Committee, and that makes sense given that she is a corporate law professor and has worked on the housing issues on the front lines for quite a long period of time. And what I like about Chairwoman Waters and what distinguishes Maxine Waters from a lot of her fellow chairs is that she's actually taken congressional oversight very seriously And she's allowed her first year members or first term members like Katie Porter, like AOC, like Rashida Tlaib to really take on the banks, to take on Trump's regulators. And it's shockingly rare. You look at just the Ways and Means Committee, which is a peer committee, a top tier committee. Richard Neal from Massachusetts has been incredibly slothful in his approach to oversight. And I think that we've been allowed to see Katie Porter become a star in part because Chairwoman Waters has enabled that, which is to Waters' credit. And Porter has the skills, the interest, and the zeal that we need to keep track of this stuff.
Well, you know, and people are saying, who is she? And, you know, a lot of them, and so I have been like educating people. Again, part of the reason why I even mentioned Katie, she will not be the VP, but it kind of gives you a template for the kind of people that Biden should be looking at. And the other sort of question I have for you is, I even suggested that more than just his VP, that he may want to start telling me, so who would be in your cabinet? Who are you considering for your cabinet? Because again, the title of your piece is Personnel is Policy. And one of the things we learned with Attorney General Barr is that all people within the executive branch who hold these incredible titles, especially, you know, EPA, you know, CDC, Attorney General, whatever it is, SEC, is that they may have a set of rules and regulations that they're asked to enforce. But prosecutorial discretion means based on where their agenda is, they can either be vigorous in some kind of prosecution or they can wink and nod and walk away from some kind of prosecution. And that the story of Mary Jo White is the perfect example of almost the anti-Katie Porter. She knew where her bread had been buttered. She knew who she was serving, and she wasn't necessarily serving the public interest because she didn't believe that white collar crime was such a problem, even though it clearly is. And the Mary Jo Whites of the world end up disappointing where the Katie Porters really tell you that the public interest is going to be served.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that having a form of shadow cabinet would be very useful because it is easy to look at what is wrong with Trump and to focus on Clorox as a medical treatment.
Yes.
And that is certainly awful and may even be consequential. When you focus solely on the man himself and the show from the White House, what that obscures is the importance of the presidency is based on the breadth of the agencies, and they all have important responsibilities, and even the ones that don't seem that important now may well be important in a year or two. And exactly. So having prospective appointees identified gives you surrogates who can help you direct the public to thinking about the presidency as it actually exists, which is a series of administrative jobs that are enormously important and often are, when they're done best, they are done with the least amount of attention paid. If you manage to avoid a pandemic, you don't think about the CDC as much. It's when you don't stop the pandemic. When you don't have a financial crisis, you don't think about financial regulators as much.
Exactly.
And so when your food safety issues, be it, you know, at the USDA, the pointing out of what is wrong with the Trump administration is one of the key jobs that the Biden campaign has before it. And having identified more prominent surrogates, people like Katie Porter, who are capable of telling a story to the public that is intelligible and consequential, I think would be a very good move by the Biden campaign.
I've been saying this is like a drumbeat. My audience has heard me say this a million times, and I've had Bill Curry from Connecticut on, and the two of us kind of agree. What we talk about is that Joe Biden is an interesting person. I think his leadership style is that he leads from behind. He's never been a great thinker. He's never been a great policy guy. He's kind of the guy that, you know, he'll become the environment in which he's in. Let's be honest, all right? And I see him almost as an amoeba and changing shape. Now the question, as you point out, is that what progressives have to start doing is recognizing what matters. And what matters isn't legislation that Joe Biden is going to be talking about, because God help him, if he doesn't have the Senate, it ain't going to happen. But what Joe Biden does have is an executive branch. if you appoint the right people in the executive branch, even if you still have a frickin' Mitch McConnell, you might be able to do some remarkable things, because what we've learned from Donald Trump in real time is that when you have a damaged president who appoints cronies into the positions of authority within the executive branch, they can literally destroy everything that you thought democracy was based on. Now we keep thinking that there are norms, and what we're finding out, there really isn't a norm. Donald Trump has proven that there are no rules. And if he's going to abuse it, he can now use his appointments and the people that he doesn't even have to get approved by to totally destroy everything we thought we understood about sort of the representative democracy we had. And I just think that the executive branch is just now becoming so much more a focus of everything that we need to care about. But that puts pressure on Biden now in a way that no Democratic nominee has ever experienced that kind of pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, term one, Obama saw the executive branch as a set of potential mistakes. Like, how could my cabinets cause me to distractions from my legislative agenda? There was a term two, Obama was much better in this regard. There was much more of a, well, I guess we're not going to be passing legislation. I'm going to see each department as a potential source of political wins. And that's how Biden's going to have to view this. The ag department might be a way to talk to rural America. Housing and urban development might be a way to give some wins to residents of cities. He needs to start seeing the executive branch as a set of opportunities for him to make his mark and leave a legacy.
Absolutely. And so the thing that I had posted on Facebook was that I really wanted him to sort of start giving us some idea of who would be in his cabinet. And everyone said, oh, no, that will just create, you know, opportunities for greater hostility, you know, in a way they don't want him to complete the sentence, you know, just let Trump be Trump and Biden be, I'm not Trump, you know, and I'm like, that's not satisfying for me. And then one of the other points that people were making is, no, you want Joe Biden to reach out to those disaffected McCain Republicans. And I'm like, where else are they going to go? I mean, come on. I don't need to reach out to them. They're stuck. And my job isn't to reach out to them. Their job is to try to figure out what happened to their damn party. And that's not our problem. That's their problem. But I think that the other reason why I like to see a cabinet that might be the kind of cabinet that Biden would want is that cabinet, as you point out, could speak to those different constituencies. Can you imagine if you have someone who really understands something about farming other than ConAg, Cargill, and Monsanto? Imagine someone who can talk about healthcare, who recognizes that when you lose your job, you can't afford COBRA, and maybe the idea of connecting a job to health insurance doesn't make sense because the pandemic is proving it is just, it doesn't work. It just increases your level of vulnerability. So I think in a bizarre way, beginning to sort of appoint some kind of, or suggesting cabinet positions, gives him an opportunity to bring in all these different constituencies, which will ensure a win in November.
Yeah, I think if you don't want your water to include lead, vote Biden is a message that might reach more than 50% of Americans.
Exactly. One of the things I wanted my audience to hear is in your piece, Personnel as Policy, it's just a fabulous read, by the way. Share with them the story of Senator Richard Shelby, because you refer to the Shelby Mafia. And I just want people to understand the kind of influence people like Shelby, a former Republican U.S. Senator, had over this administration. Because when you begin to realize what he was able to do, you are beyond appalled and understand the power. And the power wasn't in passing legislation. It was in private placement.
Yeah. So Shelby has placed proteges at institutions like the FDIC, which regulates banks, at the SEC, at the PCAOB, which is the institution that within the SEC that oversees accountants. Shelby has people at the White House, and he has people on K Street, lobbyists. And together, they will put together merger deals and get them through. They, soup to nuts, they are in charge of getting things done for Richard Shelby's corporate donors. And they have a favor bank between them. They are loyal to each other. and they have an ideological agenda to boot. And that sort of comprehensive approach to serving the needs of the Republican coalition is one that is well received by the members of the Republican coalition. And it'd be nice if progressives had the equivalent of a Shelby coalition, not on behalf of banks, but on behalf of ordinary people.
You end with, so what do we do next? So how do we bring the progressive wing of the party out of the old headset of legislation, tell me what you're doing, and bring them into the idea that people matter. Personnel is policy. Leaders do make a difference. And it's not, you know, policy is nice, but one, it has to pass. But what doesn't have to pass is the decision of the people that the next president of the United States is going to appoint. And what we are learning is that kind of power, that kind of discretion is beyond enormous. Jeff Hauser, thank you so much. Personnel is policy, absolutely fabulous. And the Revolving Door Project, I love it. I love it. Anyway, talk to you soon.
This was a lot of fun. Thanks.
All right, ciao. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Spann. Talk tomorrow. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go way on the way back when. I didn't even know you couldn't have been too much more than tame.